Makeshift Stories presents Somewhere, Sometime, an irregular series of short sci-fi and fantasy stories.
I'm sitting at my computer preparing the podcast. I have this odd feeling that I have done this before. I even feel like I've had this very same experience, sitting here writing about my sense of deja vu before, many, many times, a loop within a loop. My dog barks, I look away, and it's all gone. Maybe it was just a false sense of familiarity from my distracted mind constructed from a shallow momentary glimpse of the things around me. Or maybe not. In this month's story, a person is trapped by an apparent sense of deja vu that suggests they are living between two points in their life separated by many, many years. We invite you now to sit back and relax as you listen to Makeshift Story 61, 2012, The End of My World. Somewhere in some time, you might just feel that you've been sitting or walking in the exact same place, listening to this story before, over and over again.
We trailed after our guide up a set of narrow metal stairs bolted to the inner wall of the reactor building, and through heavy metal doors at the top, which sealed behind us, muffling the low throbs of the machines below. The guide immediately parked us in front of a row of small, thick glass windows that lined the inner concrete wall of an unexpectedly large, sterile observation gallery. All the bigger kids immediately ran, crowding around, pushing and jostling for a view. Gripped by apprehension, I hung back until my teacher finally insisted that I needed to take a look. Spotting a window crammed into the furthest corner of the gallery so tightly that no one had taken it, I cautiously approached, trying to quell my growing irrational sense of foreboding. Once at the window, I had to stand on my toes and plaster my face to its heavy lead-like glass, angling my head down until I could just barely see the staff, two stories below, dressed in white gowns, maneuvering a large heavy cylindrical object festooned with cables into position. By then, our guide, a man named Dr. Heimbecker, had abandoned us for our teacher and was whispering to her in a low conspiratorial tone when he suddenly stopped and announced in a proud, boastful voice,
"Today, kids, we are very lucky. Our staff is in the process of refueling the WR1 reactor. They are standing on what we call the reactor deck plate and are moving the fuel transfer flask into position. The WR1 is the largest heavy water moderated reactor ever to be made that's cooled by oil. It's why we call it an organic reactor. The WR1 is one of the safest reactor designs in the world, and it was developed here in our labs. Today will be our first full power run, and you will have the unique privilege of witnessing this historic event." He smiled at us, then winked at our teacher. As I turned back to the observation port, I saw a sudden flurry of concerned activity below. Something seemed to be happening that the white-coated figures in the deck plate did not like. A loud shrill noise, like an alarm, began painfully to resonate in my head. Instinctively, I covered my ears, but with no effect. Out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw my classmates back away from the windows. Instead of following their lead, I was suddenly overcome with a morbid sense of resignation as the transfer flask appeared to wobble uncontrollably, then in slow motion collide with a pile of nearby equipment. There was a brilliant silent flash, and my face, still pressed to the glass, felt like a hot summer sun had momentarily decided to materialize in the room beyond the window. Then my world melted away.
"If you look at this side of the structure, you can see that the Mayan rebuilt their monuments over top of the older ones. Some speculate that this occurred in a 52-year cycle."
A distorted, low-res voice seemed to be speaking to me from some vastly different place through a liquid atmosphere.
"Our archaeologists have excavated this area to illustrate the layering."
It continued, now closer and clearer.
"Why 52 years?
Another voice questioned through ebbing static.
"Every 52 years, the Mayan 260 and 365 day cycles synchronize. As you know, the Mayan calendar is based on cycles,"
the voice asserted, now taking on the physicality it had lacked earlier. My head throbbed from a rapidly receding migraine-induced stupor. The pain rolled back, making me aware of the intensity of the sun on my head and neck, toasting both a cherry red. I would have one bad sunburn tonight. But that won't matter, another part of my mind told me. Why wasn't I wearing a hat? I questioned, as the veil of the daydream fully lifted, leaving me exposed in the harsh tropical sun, where I found myself asking, why hadn't anyone told us about the conditions here? But I should have known better, I chided at myself. After all, we were in the center of the peninsula, 2 hours away from the theme park resorts that infested the coast. Here, on the other hand, far away from the Caribbean Sea, the scrubby, stressed jungle that encroached on the site ravenously consumed any brave wind that made it this far inland. The result was that the park stewed in the pits of artificial clearings maintained by the Mexican authorities so tourists like me could wander through the ancient city.
We'll take a break in front of the grand staircase of the observatory, or El Caracol, as we call it in Spanish, the voice proclaimed.
I followed at the back of a meandering group of people around the corner of a disintegrating structure and spotted a rough stone block squatting in the shade of a jacaranda tree, then collapsed onto it, struggling to anchor my thoughts on a tangible piece of the present, and failed. Then a tide of unexpected images picked me up and swept me away, back to the place I had just barely emerged from. The school bus lurched over a bump in the road, waking many of us up. We had assembled at the school at 7 for the field trip, and everyone was so groggy that we had fallen asleep as soon as the bus had left the city. I opened my eyes and squinted into the harsh light of a sunny autumn morning. Streaks of yellow poplar leaves set off against the deep green of spruce trees blurred past the window. The bus suddenly turned, tossing everyone against each other. Marlo, my friend from down the street, roughly pushed me back onto my side of the stiff bench seat.
"Hey, watch it," he complained. "You were sleeping again and talking. I almost changed seats. You were saying weird things," he claimed.
"I was? What did they say?"
"Something about being too hot and not prepared, I think. You were mumbling. It was hard to make out."
I looked out the window to see if I could tell where we were. Every December, my brother and I went out with our father someplace near here to cut Christmas trees, but I couldn't tell if we had passed that spot yet.
"Hey, Marlo, I think we're driving in circles. I'm sure I've seen that hill before,"
I distractedly commented.
"They all look alike, and how would you know anyway? You've been asleep most of the time."
"How much longer to go?" I asked, ignoring Marlo's comment. "Less than an hour, I think. At least that's what Miss Stanowski said a few minutes ago."
I groaned and put my coat against the window, leaned into it, and closed my eyes, falling back into a deep, dream-filled sleep. The voice took form again in the distant reaches of my consciousness.
"El Caracol is not aligned to the same grid as the other buildings here at Chichen Itza. It is 27 degrees off, aligning to the northernmost point that the planet Venus reaches at summer solstice. Over the centuries, the tower has decayed, giving it the rounded shape you expect to see in a contemporary observatory, but it was originally two concentric towers, not domed."
I felt overheated and a bit dizzy, my mind disagreeing for some reason with the place that my body claimed it found itself in. A woman took shape and sat down on the other side of the stone block I was sitting on.
"Looks like the heat is getting to you as well. Here, have some of my water,"
she generously offered, passing over an aluminum thermos, which I accepted thankfully, taking a sip of its cool contents.
"Are you on the full solstice tour?"
she politely asked. I nodded.
"So you'll be around for the gathering at El Castillo, the pyramid," she explained. "At 5, when the actual solstice occurs."
5:12. I automatically corrected, not remembering why I knew the exact time.
"Okay, if you want to be exact. Your skin is still pretty pale. You must have just come from the snow belt."
"Canada," I confessed. Unlike me, she looked well adjusted to the climate. Similar in age, she was well tanned and apparently quite comfortable in the tropical heat.
"California,"
she offered.
"My name is Tara, and you?"
"Al."
"Well, Al, I better lend you some sunblock before you regret today,"
she chuckled, laugh lines propagating across her face.
Or, I guess, depending on what you believe, that may not be an issue. Look, the guide's moving again. We better get going.
We reluctantly stood up. Our group meandered down a broad baked path lined with blankets on each side, overflowing with souvenirs, the blanket owners trying to grab the attention of the herd of tourists we were part of. Our guide shepherded us past them and through the great plaza in front of the pyramid and off to the bull court, Tara and I taking up the rear.
How long have you been down here? I eventually asked. Oh, I've been in Cancun since the beginning of the month, watching the hotels fill up. I'm fascinated with the whole phenomena. I'm writing a book about it once it's over. It's easy getting interviews. Most talk like there's going to be no tomorrow.
She paused, laughed at her own joke, and then continued.
We're lucky to be here today, you know. They limited the number of people they allowed in, so the place wouldn't be overrun. Did you see all the army trucks and the checkpoints on the way in? Can't blame them. Imagine the damage to the site if it turned into a free-for-all. How long ago did you book, anyway?
3 years, I shyly admitted.
Oops. I should watch what I say. You're one, I take it. A believer, I mean. Sorry, I hope you're not offended. Guess you already know where I stand on this. Got my ticket off the net at the last minute, from some guy who couldn't make it down here. I was lucky to get in.
I'm on the same page with you.
Tar gave me a questioning look.
I need to be here today, but not for the reason they are.
I gestured to the rest of our group.
Look, it's hard to explain without sounding irrational.
Okay,
Tara tentatively replied, as if preparing herself for some outrageous response. The guide held up a sign with our group numbers scribbled on it, signaling that we should stop.
This is the Wall of Skulls, she began. There are three around the Great Plaza and are actually from the Toltec rather than the Mayan.
As our guide launched into a lengthy historical explanation, Tara and I sat down on the closest stone block. I wiped the sweat from my face, then found myself drifting off in the oppressive heat, the present once more receding away from me.
Hey, Al. Al, you fell asleep again.
A familiar, impatient voice intruded, followed by a painful punch on my shoulder. The bus braked, swung out onto a gravel shoulder, then suddenly turned. My eyes blinked open, just in time to catch a sign which read, "Welcome to the White Rapids Nuclear Research Establishment." We twisted down a narrow tree-lined road and jerked to a stop in front of a two-story white building with thin vertical windows. Numbed by the long trip on the bouncing school bus, everyone instinctively started to stretch and talk at the same time. Suddenly, the front door swung open to admit a man wearing a white safety helmet, a white lab coat, and an odd green bar clipped to his breast pocket.
Class, Miss Stanowski yelled. Settle down. That's not the way grade 4 and 5s behave. This is Dr. Heimbecker, assistant head of research. He has kindly taken time out of his busy schedule to help us today. Please pay attention to what he says. A report on the field trip will be due next Tuesday.
Marlowe leaned over and whispered in my ear.
Hey, and if the place blows up while we're here, we won't need to do the report.
I pushed him away and scowled.
Hey, better not. I want to see the first moon landing on TV next July,
I jokingly said, as I playfully tried to push Marlowe off the bench seat.
As you exit the bus, kids, you will be given a badge like mine. You must wear it at all times,
Dr. Heimbecker directed in a stern voice.
We excitedly pushed our way out onto the warm asphalt of an early fall day. Like the snowstorm of yellow leaves, stirred by a gust of wind that swirled around us, vaguely familiar ghost images cascaded through my mind. Surprised, I turned to Marlowe and said, Hey Marlowe, I bet they're going to take us to that building over there. Then we'll go for lunch in the staff cafeteria. Then they'll take us to see a reactor. That one.
I pointed to the other side of the parking lot, where a squat windowless building poked out over the trees, beside which stood a thin metal tower with a bulb at its top.
Miss Stanowski told you that, didn't she?
Marlowe taunted.
No, I saw it in my head, at least I think.
Marlowe looked impatient.
You're just trying to mess with me, aren't you? No, I'm not,
I insisted, but Marlowe ignored me and was already walking away as our guide gathered us up into a tight group.
We'll be starting our tour on the second floor of the administration building, where our labs are located. Please remember to be quiet as we go through. The researchers will be working.
The guide warned, then started toward the white building. I made a face at Marlow.
Told you. Lucky guess,
he spat back. We paraded across the parking lot, through a set of large double glass doors and up an industrial-looking staircase at the back of a modest foyer, lined with photos of the research station's construction. The guide stopped, and we gathered around him at the top of the stairs.
I remind you again, you will need to be quiet. This is a working lab,
Dr. Heimbecker cautioned as he pushed through a set of frosted glass doors. Inside, we lined up along the edges of an expansive room, which was filled with desks, piled high with papers and typewriters. A few tables sported gray metallic boxes with scopes of varying sizes. One area of the room was filled with key punch machines, in front of which sat hypnotized operators. An assistant circulated among them, collecting neatly piled stacks of completed punch cards, then exited through a door labeled computer room. There was a large blackboard along one wall that reminded everyone that the WR-1 was being tested at full power on September 21st. Today, I realized. Dr. Heimbecker tried to introduce the head of the lab over the constant din of key punching, but the crowded room, hot with many people and machines, made it hard to concentrate, and soon the ghost images returned and carried me back into the dream.
Hey, Al, we're going to move again.
A female voice emerged from the fog of receding mechanical clatter. A gentle nudge on my shoulder followed.
Al, come on. We're going to be moving soon.
Huh?
I mumbled, feeling disoriented.
We're going back to the gate to eat lunch at the restaurant.
Concerned, Tarek suggested.
You should probably buy a hat when we get there. I think you've had too much sun. A second ago, you were mumbling and staring into space.
We followed our group back along the wide gravel path that led to the park entrance, now baking in the sun, talking, Tara explaining the background to her book.
Ever since I first heard about the end of the calendar thing, I was hooked. You know, there's always been predictions like that dating right back. Last year alone, there were four more. Did you know that around 380 BC, some Romans believed that there was a mystical number that had been revealed to Romulus? It was the same as the number of days in a year. So when 365 BC rolled around, they all expected Rome to collapse or disappear or something. Sound familiar?
Tara quizzed.
That's interesting, but like I told you, I'm not here for the same thing everyone else is. I'm not into the end of time thing. Oh, you're just here to see the sights. I'm sorry, I forgot.
She sarcastically snipped.
No doubt the fact that you spent a king's ransom to be here on December 21st, 2012 is just a coincidence.
Not feeling like explaining what I didn't fully understand myself, I simply shrugged and let Tara continue talking about herself. It took 30 minutes in the heat to make it to the low, flat, contemporary gray concrete building that formed the entrance to the historic park. We walked out of the sun into the cool green hall that ran its length. Orange-colored pillars lined each side. Our guide stopped in front of a restaurant and announced,
You will have an hour and a half here, so enjoy. I will meet you back inside at 2:30.
We followed our group into the crowded restaurant, to several tables that had been reserved for us, with little tent cards that read, Last Solstice, Premium Tour. People were staring at us as we sat down. I could imagine what was going through their minds. Tara and I decided to take a small table, somewhat isolated from the others.
I feel embarrassed,
I whispered to Tara.
Me too,
she smiled back. The rest of our group seemed oblivious to the mocking stares and solemnly took their seats. Our pre-ordered food quickly arrived and we ate mostly in silence. Finally, Tara spoke.
Well, it's obvious why I'm here, but I still don't understand why you spent all that money to take this special tour.
She stared intensely into my eyes as if she was trying to will secrets out of my mind through the optic nerves. Finally, I gave up and tried to explain.
I don't expect this is going to make any sense to you, but I have no choice. I've always had to come.
You just said you've always had to come. That implies you've done this before.
That was just a slip of the tongue. It's not what I meant to say, I insisted.
Oh, but I think it is. And I think you believe it too.
Tara looked bemused.
I like that. It's a different take. Not the end of the world, just a loop. But it still doesn't explain why you need to be here. Why now? Why this year? Why not last year? Or next summer? Or somewhere else?
I'm not exactly sure. I mumbled, embarrassed again.
I don't understand it myself. I know it sounds as flaky as the 212 thing. But ever since I was 10, I've known. I just didn't know the exact time and place. I've tried to ignore it. But the images are always there, in dreams, and sometimes even just when I close my eyes.
Tara looked at me suspiciously, but kept silent.
When the 2112 stuff hit the news a few years ago, and I saw the pictures of Chichen Itza, I instinctively knew that this was the place and time. It's ironic, though.
I nodded in the direction of the rest of our group.
Think they would assign some mystical significance to the fact that I was born 52 years ago at 5:12 p.m. on December 21st? I know I don't.
You're joking, right?
Tara questioned.
I can't verify the time. That's when my mother claimed I was born. But here, look at the date on my passport if you don't believe me.
I pulled it out and shoved it across the table at her. Tara stared at it.
I don't think it would be a good idea to tell them,
she advised, motioning her head in the direction of our group.
But that still doesn't entirely explain why you're here or what you're expecting to happen or get out of it. The dreams and daydreams. I've been falling in and out of them all my life. They're more like a strong sense of deja vu. It's like I've been here many times before. I get that weird, momentary feeling of familiarity, and it's been worse since I got here this morning. I guess I'm here to find out where the images in my head have been leading to. Maybe it'll put an end to them. Maybe it'll stop. I don't know where it's going to lead.
Interesting.
You think I'm crazy, don't you? I accused.
But I'm not.
I had it checked out. Except for the recurring dreams, I'm perfectly normal.
Well, Al, I really don't know what to make of that. But I hope today helps you find what you're looking for.
Tara sympathetically replied.
Now hold on to that thought. I've got to visit the washroom.
She got up and quickly left, and the present left with her. My thoughts drifted again, closing in around me, taking me back into their mysterious grip. I spit out a mouthful of sandwich.
It's burning my tongue. It tastes like mush. Yuck!
I complained, grabbing a cup of milk. Marlo stole the other half and took a bite.
Tastes like turkey to me.
He made a face, then finished it, wiping his hands on his pants.
What's up with you anyway today, Al? You slept for most of the trip here. Now you're acting like you're eating somebody else's lunch instead of the one in front of you. Are you sleepwalking or something? Hey!
Marlo suddenly yelled.
Wake up!
Kids from the nearby tables looked over at us, and I felt my face turn red.
I'm just feeling a bit off. Marlo, have you ever had a dream that you just can't forget, that keeps haunting you even when you're awake?
Marlo shrugged, his mouth currently too full of his own sandwich to answer.
Figures,
I added.
But I've had this reoccurring dream about going on the field trip. It's not very clear, and when I try to remember, the images just go away. But then I get these flashes, like when I was standing outside by the bus. Makes me feel like I've done this before, even telling you. But I think that's all part of the dream too, the being here before thing, I mean.
Before Marlo could get in a snide comment, Dr. Heimbecker rose and announced,
Okay, kids, lunch is over. We're now going over to see the reactor building.
I quickly put the rest of my uneaten lunch into its paper bag, then got up to follow. We exited the administration building and started across the parking lot toward the structure I'd pointed out earlier.
Hey, Al, you're sweating,
Marlo teased.
It's not that hot out. Are you scared to go into the reactor building?
A sudden shiver ran through my body. I was scared, but didn't want to admit it. I tried to trail behind Marlo, so he wouldn't notice my growing aversion to being close to the reactor. But he turned and saw me anyway.
Hey, look, everyone, Al's afraid,
Marlo taunted so loudly that even Miss Stanofsky could hear.
A few of the other kids snickered, and Miss Stanowski dropped back to talk to me.
Al, I can assure you it's perfectly safe.
She tried to calm me.
I know, I said. I studied before the field trip. It's the safest reactor in the world. I know that. That's not what's bothering me.
She gave me a concerned look. What then?
I don't know.
I began to stutter.
It's hard to explain. It's like I'm being railroaded down a track with no way to turn.
Miss Stanowski frowned.
Alan, you're not making any sense. I want to go. I want to see it. I really do. But there's a strange bit of me that's starting to say, don't go. I see. Why don't you stay with me? Nothing will happen,
she assured. But as the reactor building grew closer, my dread continued to grow. Nothing will happen, I muttered to myself, trying to quell the irrational impulse to turn and run back to the bus and wait until the tour was over. But I was determined not to completely embarrass myself in front of the class.
I'm all right, Miss Stanowski,
I finally announced, intentionally loud enough for everyone else to hear.
It's probably just something I ate for lunch that's not agreeing with me. I'll be okay, honest.
The other kids instinctively gave me more room and did their best to ignore me as we entered the reactor building through a distinctly heavy set of doors. Once inside, the voices of Dr. Heimbecker and Miss Stanowski seemed to meld with the low throb of the machines that inhabited the building, making the floor subtly vibrate. The sound invaded my ears, working its way in, shaking, latent, half-forgotten images from my dreams loose. Like water, widening a crack in a dam, they began to flood my thoughts, sweeping me away.
Al? Al? You're drifting again.
Tara's voice drew me to the present. I found myself staring out of the restaurant window at the scrubby jungle that had invaded the park grounds, watching tourists scurrying through the paths in clumps.
What were you thinking about?
Tara asked as she slid back into her seat.
I'm not sure. It may have been a memory from when I was a kid. I was on a school field trip to a nuclear research station and didn't really want to be there. I was panicked, in fact. That's all I remember.
Maybe that's your problem. Got too much of a dose of radiation back then. Do they irradiate all kids in Canadian schools?
Tara teased.
I can't believe they'd even take a school class to see a reactor. That's weird.
That was over 40 years ago. It was different times back then. And really, it was only a research station,
I defensively claimed.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now continue with the Solstice Tour. We have 2 hours before the celebration in the Great Plaza, so first we will go see the Sacred Cenote, then over to the market, and back to El Castillo in time for the event.
The tour guide, who had just arrived back, announced. Our group quietly rose, some pushing wads of $100 bills under their plates as they stood.
I'm assuming that you're expecting to survive, no matter where today leads you. And if you do, you owe me dinner. I want to pick your brains for impressions, for the book,
Tara playfully commented. But I wasn't listening. My mind was busy trying to pull all the pieces together.
You know, I don't even think that field trip I was dreaming about ever even happened,
I blurted out, more to convince myself than tell Tara.
I've been wondering if someone just told me about it when I was young. Maybe it's just a false memory, and I don't really need to be here. Well, Al, that's the most rational thing you've told me today. So now that you think you've figured it out, you should just relax and enjoy the rest of the tour and celebration. After all, you paid an awful lot to be here today.
I sat for a moment watching the rest of our somber group file out of the restaurant, thinking.
Come on, Al, let's go. There's going to be a lot of disappointed people in 2 hours, and I need to document it. Hey, look, I'll give you a research credit in the book if you help me,
Tara cheerfully offered. The sacred cenote turned out to be further than I had imagined, and in the heat of the late afternoon sun, despite the fact that the park had been closed since 10 a.m., new tour groups seemed to have spontaneously appeared and converged on to the already crowded path we walked along. There was an impossible number of small vendors lining the route, each vying for the opportunity to sell their wares, and today the majority of the crowd enthusiastically obliged, loading up on anything offered, and not quibbling about the price and even overpaying. In the infrequent spots devoid of the vendor's blankets, piles of hastily discarded souvenirs were being attacked by young kids who had been paid by the merchants to return their wares, and knowing smiles were everywhere in their ranks.
In another hour or two, I bet the whole pretense of trade will break down, I carefully ventured. The tour groups will just start throwing their leftover money.
Makes sense, doesn't it? Why would you need money if you thought the world was about to end? But I've noticed that you haven't been throwing your cash away. I assume that's a good sign.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going to end up.
I replied, trying to sidestep a plaster replica of El Castillo that had been abandoned in the middle of the path by someone in front of us.
I only have the vague feeling that I'm being led to a specific place and point in time for some reason. A gateway to a different reality, no doubt.
Tara sarcastically smiled.
And that's why you're an interesting fanatic. At least you believe you're going to be around, somewhere, for a bit longer than 5:12 p.m.
Despite my confidence in the fact that my fate wasn't connected to what the people currently around us believed would or would not happen, I had rapidly growing doubts.
Tell me more about why you want to write the book,
I said, trying to steer the conversation in a different direction. We had finally arrived at the sacred cenote, viewed, I suspected, as a sideshow to the main act by most of the group who casually ignored the deep natural well. Their disinterest allowed Tara and I to walk right up to the thin rope barrier and peer down into its dark, cool maw. By now, our guide had more or less given up on the standard tour script and simply said,
"Can I have your attention? You will have 45 minutes here. Then we will walk back to the Great Plaza for the celebration."
No one seemed to complain that she had dropped the market from our itinerary.
"Your book,"
I reminded Tara. She hesitated, then with a pained look on her face, leaned close and whispered,
10 years ago, I lost my husband and daughter to a cult. At first, I wasn't really aware it was happening. They found a group and began to spend more and more time with them. I didn't really know what the group was about, but I was happy that they had found something they could do together. Then slowly, they both seemed to drift away. At the time, I just thought we were all too busy with our lives. By the time I realized what was happening, we were living in vastly different worlds under the same roof. After a year, they decided that they didn't want to have anything to do with me and moved out. They ignored all my attempts to contact them.
I'm sorry,
was all I could think to say.
Thanks, but there's no need to feel sorry. That was a long time ago. I've recovered,
Tara coldly stated.
But I was devastated at first. Eventually, I became determined to understand how something like that could happen. When the 212 stuff started, I saw an opportunity to learn, to understand what makes a mind susceptible to ideas like that, and how it can displace everything else that's important to a person. That's really what the book's about. That's why I'm here. I want to witness this, but I'm not sure what to expect when they...
She gestured to the crowds wandering around us.
Are confronted with the physical truth. What will happen to their belief? Will they abandon it and reconnect with their former lives and loved ones? That would at least give me some hope. Or will they just find another fiction to replace it? I don't know, but I need to find out. I do know that you're not one of them, and as you say, you're on a different path, and that interests me.
We found a bench in the shade, and Tara told me about the research she had done to date. I decided I wanted to help her, but somehow knew it would not be, and that made me sad. I felt my future was already set, and so close now that its gravitational field was not going to easily let me go. Our guide eventually herded us together for the walk back to the Great Plaza. As I had predicted, the pretense of commerce had broken down. The tour groups around us were simply handing their money away. By the time we arrived back at the plaza, the celebration had already started, music floating out from a hastily erected temporary stage. Our guide parked us in a reserved area between the stage and the pyramid, identified by our tour number, which had been posted on small signs that formed the corners of a roped-off area. The best location money could buy, the brochure had claimed, to watch the sun fall behind El Castillo at the moment of the solstice. Some people sat down on the ground to meditate, others on chairs, still others chose to dance. Tara and I chose to stay at the edge to take it all in, while the sun finished climbing to its zenith, then began to fall. During this time, despite my best efforts, the seed of doubt germinated and grew.
Tara, I'm getting this feeling. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what I should have done is stay home. Maybe that was the answer I've been trying to find. I don't think I should be here. It's a mistake.
I announced in a panicked voice, knowing that it was already too late. But Tara wasn't listening. Instead, she was watching the anxious crowd, eavesdropping on the hushed, frantic voices near us. A man near the edge of the growing mass of celebrants had fainted, and many others looked like they were about to. Chanting broke out as the sun began to descend toward the pyramid, growing in intensity until the edge of the blinding disk touched the top of El Castillo. It then started to slip behind, casting long inky shadows that began to consume the ground. Darker than any shadow I had ever seen, it crawled determinedly toward us. I instinctively wanted to turn and run, but the other groups had crowded in behind us, making an escape impossible, forcing me down my reluctant chosen path. Like a succulent treat, the ancient monument appeared to be savoring the sun as it slid down the sky, consuming the yellow globe until it was gone. The chanting suddenly stopped, and a deafening silence unfolded around me. I felt the present dissolve and drift away like smoke in a breeze. Then there was nothing. A void. And for a brief moment, I understood my mistake and made an effort to remember. The formless began to take shape, and the world slowly reemerged from some distant, unknowable place where it had been hiding from me.
Alton!
The sound tried to form in my head.
Alan!
It came, this time from outside.
Alan, are you all right?
It asked in a concerned tone. I wriggled my toes and fingers, surprised to find them, then opened my eyes. I was staring up at a ceiling, parallel rows of fluorescent lights glowing down. A coolness was working its way in from my back. I was on the floor. A shadowed head floated into view.
Alan, Alan.
It repeated, then the fuzzy pieces of sight and sound that had been dancing around me fell into place, and I saw Miss Stanowski, my teacher, leaning over me, and behind her crowded the rest of the class.
But, the accident,
I began to stutter. Miss Stanowski looked confused.
You mean the large cylinder thing? Oh, that,
she began to look relieved.
We were so worried about you, Alan.
Our guide, Dr. Heimbecker, loomed into view, hovering just behind Miss Stanowski.
Just a minor problem, son. Nothing to worry about. But you're another story. You were out for almost 10 minutes. We were worried.
The flash of light. I felt its heat on my face.
I protested.
Son, there was no flash of light. Dr. Heimbecker, visibly reddening, corrected. You just passed out. It was in your mind.
I tried to push myself up onto my elbows and immediately felt faint. I looked down and noticed that my badge, the one that Dr. Heimbecker had insisted we wear, was gone.
Don't try to move, Alan. The nurse has been called. She's on her way. Did you feel ill before you fainted? I know you were very anxious about something.
Miss Stanowski placed a rolled-up coat on the floor for me to put my head back down on.
I thought...
I began, struggling to organize the rapidly fading fragments that swirled around in my head.
That I was somewhere else, and somehow here at the same time. But there's something I need to remember.
I desperately insisted. Then the fading fragments momentarily fell together, and I knew. My old world had finally ended.
I could move on.
Thanks for listening to Makeshift Stories 61, Somewhere, Sometime, 2012, The End of My World. We hope that you enjoyed this month's story. And as always, if you like what we are doing, please tell your friends about us or write a review on iTunes. We love hearing your comments, so send us an email to makeshiftstories@gmail.com. A quick note, in the next month, for technical reasons, we will be dropping some of our older episodes from our feed, but they will still be available on the Makeshift Stories website. So for our older stories, please head over to makeshiftstories.com. The opening and closing theme is Pod Safe Music by David H. Makeshift Stories is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivative License, which means you're free to share our stories, just remember to credit us and don't alter anything.